Welcome to this episode of the Comedy Defect Podcast. My name is Winter, I'm a comedian, and this is my show. Those that are new to the show, welcome. Those that are old to the show, thanks for coming back, guys. I am so excited about this podcast, because one of my comedy heroes when I first started was like, oh, what is this guy doing? How can I do that? That's what I want to do. I want to just be free and connected and just be like a comedy... Neanderthal is a compliment. It's just being there with them and enjoying the moment and just riffing and just seeing what happens. And it was wonderful to watch. I absorbed all of his stuff online. He's just such a great talent. It is, of course, the excellent comedian Tony Law. Now, you could find Tony on all the socials as Mr. Tony Law. And look, go and check him out. If you haven't seen any of his stuff, go and find him on YouTube and then come back and listen to this podcast. He is such a great talent and a unique talent. I don't know what more to say about this one, but he's such a great guy. And he also does his own Twitch stream, and it's called the Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo. And that's on Twitch, and it's called the Tone Zone. The Tone Zone, and it's called the Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo. And go and check that out. I don't want to spoil it because we talk a lot about the stuff that I don't want to do in the intro. I want you to hear it on the podcast. But look, he has some great nuggets of information. As I say, there's some great nuggets that we pick up along these podcasts of what you do with comedy and how people approach it and how they feel about comedy, how they're passionate about comedy. And this guy made me passionate about comedy. I was like, well, you can do that? You can actually do that? I was like, that's amazing. I want to do that. You know, and it lights a fire under me when I hear this stuff back again, because you can get so jaded in comedy and you can be, oh, we can't do that. Yeah, you can. You can do whatever you want. You can find your own comedy. You find your own sort of path, and this is what Tony did. But yeah, it's great. So go and find him on the socials, Mr. Tony Law. Go find him on Twitch, the Tone Zone, Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo. That's what it is. So yeah, Tony Law, he's absolutely excellent. Anyway, you can find me on all the socials as well. Winter Dominus, that's me, Winter Phone Under. And if you're going to go to Facebook and like the Comedy Defect podcast page, do that. Join the group as well. I'll just post the podcast there and also gig dates that I've got coming up. I don't have many at the moment. I'm doing my own gigs at the moment around Hertfordshire, but the thing is, I've broken my leg, so I'm just learning to walk again. No joke, honestly, guys. No joke, honestly. I can't literally do stand up at the moment. My legs are broken. But anyway, look, you know, talk to me. Message me on Instagram if you want to hear more about it. Look, you see some of my Instagram posts anyway about what's happening there anyway. So yeah, if you like this podcast and you want to donate, you can. Look, but you know what? I'm getting by. I'm doing all right, thanks. But you know, sure, why not? If you want to tip me, why not? You can go to Patreon, type in The Comedy Defect Podcast, type that in, donate as much or as little as you feel this podcast is worth. But you can't donate, that's all right. Just share your favorite episode, or don't tell anyone about it, because look, you know, I don't want too many people listen to it, because some great bits of information here, which, you know what, right? I want to keep for myself, really. But like, but if you want to do that, it tells me where we are and what we're up to, but which I don't really want them to know. But you know, whatever you feel like you want to do with it, it's out for the public, you know, consumption anyway. So look, so yeah, and that's all the social stuff out of the way. So look, this is one of my favorite episodes. Ah, Tony Law is great. Episode 110 with a brilliant comedian. And I don't know, just sort of adventurer, Tony Law. Enjoy. Mr. Tony Law, thank you so much for spending the next hour and a tiny bit with me talking about comedy and your life. How are you getting on?
Not too bad, actually. I had my moments during the lockdown, but yeah. I've actually, because I lucked out near the end and got a couple of voiceovers, I started to, it's like Stockholm syndrome. Yeah. I feel like I like it now. Yeah. Because I was able to make a living.
Great.
And that made me think, I wonder if you were able to stay working, whether the lockdown was really so bad for some people. Yeah. Bad for my kids, though. They had to be around me all the time, so.
How did you manage with that?
I think our relationship is more complicated.
Right.
No, I am thick as, I didn't realize I was so poorly educated.
Right.
I knew it was pretty bad. No, it's pretty bad. So I had to do a lot of studying the night before I would do a lesson with them.
Right, okay.
And they're 11.
So you had to do like Zoom stuff as well, did you? Or was that possible?
Yeah, so my son's school did Zoom, thank goodness. Yeah. They were amazing.
Oh, yes.
But my daughter is homeschooled. So my wife's doing that anyway. And with maths, she's got someone that does it for her because there's no way either. Both of us are as bad as each other, actually. Yeah. We're the most poorly educated people in our block, I'm sure of it.
Well, that's okay. I mean, look, that's it. We can connect with everyone then, really, isn't it? That's fine. It's, those voiceovers, what do you mind talking about them? What was it that were they for?
So the one I got at the beginning of the lockdown was to do Sky Comedies. Some of the links on Sky
excellent.
Comedy.
Yeah.
Coming up at 9, it's Two Dope Queens.
Great.
And I would put in my angle was that the other ones, they'll try and write a little joke or a link about the show. Was I would put little snippets in from my life. You know, when I was 12, my buddy Terry Ackerman used to roll me down the hill in an old car or whatever and then go, coming up next, it's AP Bio. So great. I would just do weird little things like that.
Nice.
So
nice.
That one was regular and helped get through. And then I did, you know, I did a few deliveries, not like I didn't get a job for Tesco or anything. Those are hard to get.
Oh, yeah.
But I did a few deliveries for a friend's local business delivering sausages around, and that was fun. That kept me sane.
Is it like like organic sausages or something like that, or is it just like
he gets them made by they're called Big Apple Hot Dogs, and they're really popular. He's got a few different suppliers and sausageers or whatever they're called.
Yeah,
and he knows all the best recipes that he wants, and then he does events and stuff. So there was none of those on, so he was shipping it around to people buying bulk. So my other friend builds and maintains windmills now. That's a long story though. He sort of fell into that. So I delivered a few parts for him. That was good. Because I love a long drive. That was the big part of comedy I was missing.
Yeah, what is that, up on the mountains or something?
They're not the super giant ones. Mm. They're the sort of medium-sized ones.
Okay.
And they're usually on farms or, you know, a business that's got enough land. They can make back quite a bit of money from the putting it into the grid.
Yeah, man, definitely.
Like if I had the land, I'd have one of those babies up.
With the sausages thing, is it? Are you on any, like, because a lot of comedians, they're on special sort of diets, you know, maybe like they're treating themselves like sprinters of some kind, you know, like they measure out their macros and everything. Do anything like that, Tony?
No, I am old school.
Right?
I mean, I'm blessed with an incredible physique. So, sure, it's on the heavier side, but One of the things my friend, he would also paid me very generously, but he would also give me a packet of them.
Oh, nice.
And they really are fantastic. But one of my kids is vegetarian.
Right.
So that's always tricky. Then you got to go to the shop. You've got a free batch of these big, juicy sausages.
Yeah.
You still got to go to the shop.
Yeah.
For the one.
That's it. So you have a favorite then?
Yeah, actually, she is my favorite. No.
Oh, nice.
No, that's they're it. Both my favorites.
Great.
I guess,
that's great.
Yes. Another one. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say it yet.
Right.
I'll give you a hint.
Yeah, I can take it out if it's a problem.
It's a tasty beverage, and I prefer the diet version of it.
Okay. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right.
It's probably the biggest one.
Amazing. Right.
Of all those soft drinks, I lucked out and got that.
Yeah.
So I've been pretty damn lucky, and then I've been doing my stream every. God, I've been doing it now. I think I've done 300 episodes, maybe. Called The Tone Zone on the Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo Network. And it's just a stream on Twitch where I play videos, just weird stuff off of YouTube. So train journeys from the driver's eye view, city walking tours, you know.
Cool.
So did the Forum in Rome. And then I sing old Roman legionary songs with them. And just kind of, and then we judge the 2002 Panorama Finals. That's the Trinidad and Tobago steel band competition.
Right.
Because I was at the 2001 one.
Okay.
We watched curling the other night. It's actually surprisingly funny. And I've got my friend in a booth wherever he lives, Norfolk.
Yeah.
He's the one whose computers we beam through.
Right.
And my head's floating on screen, and he's just a dislocated voice. So his voice are disassociated. So his voice is like he's got a really high voice like that. Through a filter. So it's kind of robot-y sound. And he sings along and stuff, and I shout at him. And
You've got a body on the show, which you kind of like just riff on the videos that you content that you put up as well. That sounds like fun.
If I'm doing a really good comedy, surreal comedy riff, and then he butts in, man, I lose my temper. Because you know what it's like when you get on a riff. Yeah. You're on a riff, and you need focus, even if it looks like it's mayhem. You're in the zone, and then if someone cuts you off, I think I need to seek therapy though. Because of my how easily I get distracted. It's medical, I think.
But are you afraid that like if you got therapy for it, it just would ruin your act?
No, I think it would buy me calmness and chill.
Right, okay.
And be more confident. I think it's a confidence.
Yeah.
If you're confident, you know you can get it back, even if someone butts in.
So you're Canadian, Tony.
Yes, sir.
When you were going to school in Canada, what was the thing that kind of like brought you to kind of move into comedy? Like, did you have the origin story, if you like?
So where I grew up is very blue collar place, you know, farms. I grew up on a farm.
Right. What kind of farm?
When I was on the farm, we had pigs, cattle, and loads of grain. So wheat, barley, canola.
What's canola?
Rapeseed over there. It's rapeseed, but they don't like saying that. So they don't like canola. And you were expected, like, when you got out of high school, you were going to go straight into farming, or you might get a job in town at Fountain Tires or the feed mill or whatever, and you'd work your way up that way. And I just saw on the horizon, like, that, like, there was no ever talk of university or anything like that. Like, I didn't even know anyone who went. I knew a few people who went to technical college.
Right.
But so there was none of that on the horizon. So to me, it felt bleak because I knew I wasn't cut out to be a farmer. Like, I wasn't smart enough. They're quite savvy, and they've got to have their fingers in a lot of pies. Also, I just didn't like the bleakness of working at Fletcher's Fine Foods in the abattoir.
Yeah.
But I didn't know there was any other route out of it. And that was always funny. But that still, comedy wasn't an idea. I had to get out and go traveling. I went traveling, and my mom visited me when I was in London, and we went to the Comedy Store, and I remember coming out just thinking, that is amazing. Yeah. But it's still, I thought there's no way I could do that. Hmm. There's no way, because I thought you had to go to university to do it, or something like that, or be from the city. I don't know, it just seemed, and I only wanted to check out the UK because of the music, back to where my heroes come from, The Who. But I didn't even have a plan of getting into music, just being there. Anyways, I guess I had been in London for 10 years when I finally got up the courage. I was working in a bar down in Turnham Green, Chiswick. Right. One of the regulars in there was Lenny Henry's brother, Paul Henry. And he used to laugh at me when I would get going behind the bar.
Yeah.
Laugh. And he just kept saying, "You are funny, man. You've got to do this." And I was like, "What?" And it was his confidence building in me over a 6-month period and he ran a gig as well. And he gave me my first gig, and then I was hooked after that.
Where was the gig?
In Chiswick. I can't remember the name of it. Oh, I was terrified. I drank way too much, and it wasn't that good. Knew I had to keep doing it. Then I went and I did the Glastonbury Comedy Festival, because someone had saw me at one of them. And I won that, and I thought, well, that's it. Now I'm going to be famous. But I didn't realize you had to keep hustling and doing gigs.
Yeah.
So there was a few years there where I didn't do any gigs. Just was working in the bar, and I'd do the odd one. And then I went to the Edinburgh Fringe for the very first time. And I thought, holy shit, I didn't even know about this. What is this? It's all comedy. And I remember seeing, you know, Rich Hall, Garth Marenghi, Mighty Boosh, and Simon Munnery. And I just thought, like, I'd never even heard of who Nietzsche was until I saw a Simon Munnery show. So I went and read about, because I've always been one of those, you know, those self-educated kind of working class type, you know, like your Andrew Maxwell type. So I was always a big reader, but I had no idea about philosophy or any of that stuff. Yeah. So it's Simon Munnery, and I thought, you can do this in comedy? Because I was doing stand-up the way I had seen it at the Comedy Store or on telly. Like, you had to do setup, punchline, observations about life. And I was shit at it. Like, I remember Ed Byrne go up and do exactly what I was trying to do and be brilliant at it. And then it was like someone like the Boosh, I started to do stuff I thought was funny. And then it was Ross Noble who said to me, you got to stop everything you're doing and just do what you want to do and do it on your own in your own venues. And yeah. I listened to that advice 7 years after he gave it to me. Actually, it was closer to 9 years after he gave it to me. And boy, he was right. That's when things started for me. So by then, I'm nearly 40, but or not quite. It was before that, actually. So 2009. Yeah, and then Stuart Lee got me to open for him on his tour.
Brilliant.
And, so there's my origin story.
That's great. The
boring.
No, not at all. I mean, I know you've said it many times before. I get it. It's like, you know, it's locked in now. When you were like growing up in Canada, going through the farming stuff. I mean, I had this sort of like if I grew up in West Cork in Ireland, and there was the same sort of thing though, like all around me. But we didn't have a farm. We had a couple of goats. We had like chickens. But you know what? Right, that would have lasted us 6 months if we had to really survive off. Do you know what I mean? We weren't going to make any money from that.
Yeah, that's why I feel so at home. And like most of Ireland's like that outside of Dublin, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. Like rural, very much, you know. And it's beautiful. I mean, I went away traveling as well, like just trying to get out of the small town, you know, and just trying to see what the world was like. And like you're just trying to like absorb some information that wasn't sort of, there must be something else. And you're seeking something, but you don't know what it is yet. And you're just, you know, searching and you find it. And that's the thing, you lock onto that. And it's like, that is a thing. That looks like the hardest thing.
I've always found it very familiar in Ireland, well, especially Northern Ireland, but that's because Dad's family's from there.
Right.
But all of Ireland felt vaguely familiar from the things you're kind of saying. You were saying there.
The thing is, if you try to go further than the people from your local area, there's that kind of, who does that person think they are? Like, you know.
Oh God, yeah. I had a bit of that when I went home and in betweens. Yeah, only from the odd person. Like a lot of people were very encouraging. Jeez. Like I even had one guy say, so tell me, are they still communist over there?
Right. Wow.
I was like, you know, but most of them were more knowledgeable than that. And also just really positive. Get the odd one like, oh, Tony thinks he...
Yeah. Who do you think you are, boy? Who do you think?
The city, yeah.
Yeah. The big shot coming home. Like, that's it. Yeah. That's it.
So did you, have you... Like my accent has changed. Has your accent changed?
Very much so. I had to slow it right down. I had to slow it right down so people could understand what I was saying. Because like when I go home, it comes out an awful lot and it's fine. But I say when you come over here, they go, what are you saying? I've no idea. It's like, you know.
Well, ours is much more easily intelligible, but it's a very slow accent, you know, like that. And it actually has started to come back in the last few years because I've, you know, phoning home a lot more. Well, you know, with FaceTime and all
great.
That.
Great. Free, yeah.
So I sound more like my dad again.
Oh, nice.
Than I did 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Which is, that's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, totally. I've got the odd in it because my son talks about that. Not that's quite, but he's like, Dad, pass my bowl.
He's got like the roadman accent coming up, is he?
Well, I thought if I was going to have English kids, they were going to sound like, sound like a spy. But my son is like, he goes to quite a tough school. And he talks like that. And my daughter has a more kind of, you know, sing-songy Englishy accent. But that's because she takes after mum.
Right,
Because the mummy used to have a northern accent. Well, she had a posh accent. Mm. And then she had that beaten out of her when at school. So she developed a Yorkshire accent.
Right.
And then that changed because her mum didn't like her talking like that at home. So then she spoke a kind of a flat middle. And that's where my daughter sounds.
Yeah, that's it.
They make fun of me all the time. Like, geez, Dad, how's it going, Dad?
That's great.
Oh, I'm so humble. I'm from a farm. Yeah. I'm humble.
you've got brothers and sisters, Tony?
I do, yeah.
What are they up to?
The eldest took over the farm from Dad.
Oh, yeah, great.
He's an absolute workaholic. I've felt inferior ever since. No. He's never stopped working for his whole life, and it's just, I have to look at that, and I just think, I don't know. The other brother worked just as hard. He went and worked out on the oil patch. And
oh, right.
Worked his way up, and he lived in this trailer in Cochrane, Alberta, while he was working a full-time job, and he had kids in the trailer, and then put himself through university on his own. Study took him 6 years and he got a master's degree. First one in our, like, we're all going. I remember Dad even saying, well, what's he doing that for? He's got a damn family. And like, none of us could figure out what is wrong with him.
Yeah.
Why is he doing that? What is he going to be a Was he going to be a teacher? What the fuck is
sorry,
he doing?
Sorry, you cut off.
A business degree.
Business degree. I just missed the.
And then he worked really hard and moved his way up in BP, and he retired at my age.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Amazing.
So I have those two.
Yeah, people to look up to.
Workaholics. And yeah, dad's attitude already seemed to work for them. You know, the kind of mean old. And they seem to really respond to it. But for me, it just made me shrink. Because he put us to work on the farm like all farm kids do. When you're young, you get home. First thing you do when you get home from school is you go down and you do your chores. You feed the pigs, feed the cattle, clean out the thing, and then, haul the honey. And then on weekends, you castrate pigs. So you do all. They really responded well to him. I feel like it knocked the work ethic out of me. Well, when you're doing comedy and you're sitting there, it doesn't feel like you're, sitting down and thinking of jokes.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel like work. Or if you sit down at a typewriter and type, that's not a job. Feel like you're lazy, even if you're writing something. Writing seems like
sedentary. Yeah. Just sort of like, I know what you're saying. That was my next question. I was going to say to you, like, do you think that all that stuff? I mean, because when I was growing up in Ireland, like, I of course didn't have a farm. I just did, like, the little mucking out the goats and stuff as well, and the chickens and whatever it was. It wasn't 6 o'clock in the morning starts. It was like, whenever, like, we let them out. You know what I mean? But like, they weren't on a timetable like cows or pigs would be, unless the cockerel was there. Then you wake you up anyway. It didn't matter. Like with the, I had my first job when I was about maybe 13. I was working a building site, and then
that's tough.
But like, I was just there just for comedy value, like, just because I was so weak at the time, like lifting a bucket of cement.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd get it all over myself. Like, I was trying to make a cast of my own body,
Do they make you go look for stuff?
Oh, yeah, all
exist?
The time. All the time.
Did you ever get sent out for a skyhook?
No, not one of those, no. But like,
when I left high school, the first job I, or one, not the first one, but one of them was, I worked in this oil well plant where they made parts. Oh my God, I was so thick. They would say, you got to go get a sky hook, Tony. Go down to the tool shed or whatever, and you'd have to go and check in and say, I need a sky hook. And then they'd send me all around the factory.
Yeah.
All around. And 30, 40 minutes later, I get back and I get shouted at by my boss.
Oh, yeah.
That isn't a thing, dumbass. But the irony was, they'd call me dumbass and stupid, but at the same time, they used to call me college boy because I used to read a lot. And I just thought, holy shit. It's only in hindsight, I wish I was smart enough to say, if I was a college boy, wouldn't I be in college?
Exactly.
I'm here with you doing a lesser thing than you're doing. Like, I never really got my head around that insult.
The irony.
College boy.
You're calling me the thing.
Yeah, what are you doing, college boy? I'm 18. I'm with you. I'm not in college. That's when you go, dumbass.
That's right. Was it for your first start working with those guys? You kind of like, right. I was like, I'm really young, so I had nothing to say. Confidence very low. Didn't say anything for about 3 years, and then after I opened my mouth, that was it. I was finished because they just had something on me then. That was it. I kept quiet for a couple of years, and then just started to weevil out, eat stories out of me. I was like, okay, now I've given them information to destroy me with. What was your worst job you've done, like trying to support the joy of comedy?
Well, my worst job, I think, is long before I did comedy. And that'd be working at Fletcher's Fine Foods at the abattoir, where I should have been grateful, and I was a bit. Dad pulled some strings to get me the job there. He knew the guy who owned Fletcher's Fine Foods. And it was really good money. It was like 15 bucks an hour, maybe?
Yeah,
I can't remember. But it was really good. Everyone who worked there were just grateful to have it. And I guess I just couldn't get my head around it. It didn't turn me into a vegetarian or anything. I couldn't handle the banter.
Yeah, it's heavy.
There were a lot of tough guys there, and a lot of bikers used to work there. And they're really, just good, nice people, but they were tough. And I just I've never been very tough. I remember their bikes parked out front, and there was something intimidating about it. But it was also the guts of it, like when I was separating hearts.
Yeah.
On the gut line, the conveyor belt goes by with all the guts on it, and you're separating them into their different places they got to go. And they would wash all the hearts in a big cylinder, be dumping buckets of hearts into it. So, like a bucket of 10 hearts is heavy. They're big. And I used to have nightmares every single night. And I remember I was broken up with my childhood sweetheart at the time of working there. Fuck.
Oh, God. Like, this is so fitting. Like, you know, wow.
My greatest regret is, like, I don't know how to write or I've never really been taught how to write an essay. And I should really get over my insecurity and take some class or something, because there's probably some good stories to tell. Everybody seems to be a writer, don't they?
Funny you should say that, right? Your A-levels, you can do A-levels like as a course. Keep toying with that idea, because I did terrible in English in school. I barely passed. I kind of was a bit rebellious in school, and I was like, oh God, I gotta do this thing. I was like, and just kind of didn't, because I thought
education wasn't important to our people.
Yeah. Yeah.
They weren't educated themselves, and when you become a comedian, you meet all other comedians like you and I, and there's a divide in comedy. There's the ones who they've been to college, and they know how to write stuff, and they end up getting jobs in writing as well as doing stand-up, and so they're kind of in a more confident position, whereas you meet some of us dudes out there. I've met some guys that are just like the funniest person I've ever met.
Yeah.
You think they should be on TV all the time, but they're not, because they're not able to translate it into the right format, like write a sitcom or stuff like that.
And also maybe it's a confidence thing as well, because I mean, I think that coming from you're talking about confidence there, it's like coming from a background like that where, you know, you're no better than you ought to be sort of thing, you know, you shouldn't be better than you ought to be. There's that kind of, it's always that kind of that slightly a huge amount of self-hatred, and you've got to try and fight that until you can get to the other thing.
And also, like in our family, the last 10 years of my childhood, we were doing okay. Like, so on the one hand, you had Alfie and Gertie come over from Belfast, and both from abject poverty. All their years in Canada is even worse poverty. They don't know how to farm, but suddenly they're farming. And so Dad grows up in poverty, but then when things just were at the right time to be a farmer and a hard worker, and so he started to do okay. So I grew up not feeling that thing you get from, I was dead poor. I mean, we were quite poor for the first 10 years of my life. But after that, we went to restaurants. We got to fly to Trinidad.
Yeah, wow.
Where my mom was from.
Right.
Because Dad worked on the oil rigs when he went out to work when he was 15 on the rigs. And they said, do you want to go to Trinidad? And none of the other rednecks wanted to go to Trinidad. So him and his twin brother went down there, and they both came back with Trinidadian wives. So he lived down there. So he had a broad, open mind of the world.
Great.
That, I think, him and mom, is the reason I was able to look out. You know, they weren't like college professors, but they at least offered me, oh shit, Trinidad. So I would go to Trinidad at, I think, 11 and some, and I just would be there for 3 or 4 months because it was too expensive to fly there for 2 weeks. You'd go for a few months. And I just had loads of Trinidadian friends.
Great.
And I've got cousins who are all different shades,
who
are like related to me, and it's the weirdest. So I was lucky, really lucky, because obviously I was doing better than a lot of those dudes. So I didn't have that angry fight.
Yeah,
like, I come
from nothing.
Dad had that his whole life.
That's
that
it.
Chip on his shoulder.
Yeah,
I inherited the chip, but I haven't earned it.
Yeah, you have a little, like a bit of a groove. not a full chip. Like, it's not a crack that's going to break it. It's just a little bit of a notch.
Spilt glue that's hardened on a lump on my shoulder. I've got that.
That's good. That's good to have a bit of something behind you, for sure, but not hopefully it doesn't overtake you completely.
Well, because I read a lot, and I was also really intrigued with people who had been to college and in awe of them, that, you know, you could have a conversation about stuff.
Yeah.
I suppose I started to talk differently. You know, I started to sound, because I was well into history, so I could talk about history with people. And then, I mean, that's the great thing about comedy, is later on, when Twitter started, I got cocky and became, well, so I used to drink an awful lot. Mm. And but the one, everyone only talks about the downsides of alcoholism.
Yeah.
But some of the good sides are it makes you confident.
And totally.
During the times when you're in control of it, or right on the edge, you do things like on Twitter, get in touch with Mary Beard and show her pictures of your daughter reading. We would watch her documentaries, and my daughter would always say, where's Mary's bike? Because she would always push this bike through in her documentaries. And I got in touch with her and said, my daughter wants to know where you're putting your bike in the documentaries. She got back in touch. Anyway, we eventually became sort of friends. Oh. And then she would come to my gigs and stuff. She's a real laugh. You know, Mary Beard, the classics professor from the Cambridge University.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was amazing. And they like having a friend like Tony, I think, sometimes.
Of course.
He's a bit of a wild card. And then I got, when I started getting some success in 2011, 2012, 2013, I got invited to do the Teenage Cancer Trust gig out at the Royal Albert Hall.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 8,000 people. Also, the patron or the guy who started is Roger Daltrey. He's like a hero of mine. My wife and I went there all gussied up for the big show. And she went and, you know, it's you're under the thing like, you know, when you see the backstage tour stuff of the rock bands in the big underground dressing room areas. Suddenly Storm's not there and I'm looking around going, oh shit, and I'm nervous. She comes around the corner and she's got her arm around Roger Daltrey. Great. And she goes, look, there he is. So she's gone and found Roger Daltrey. And then she goes, look at him, he's, because I started to cry.
Oh, yeah.
And she goes, look at him, he's crying. Oh. Roger went, don't cry, Mike. Oh. You know, he's such a geezer. And then that was one of the most romantic things anyone could ever do. And
so nice.
And he goes, oh, Sean, listen, mate, you can't be worried about this room. It's a lovely room.
Yeah.
And I'm going, room?
Yeah.
Roger, this is a room? Well, and then, it dawned on me, oh, of course, compared to Wembley Stadium, I suppose it is a room.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know why I jumped into that. I just wanted to name drop Mary Beard and Roger Daltrey.
Like, wonderful. Like, I mean, that's so that in your comedy journey. Oh, just sounds so basic now. It's like, oh my God. So I should wash my mouth out after I said that now.
The only problem with that, though, was I couldn't share it with anyone back home because my mom and dad never knew who Mary Beard was. So it didn't impress them. They didn't even know. Didn't impress her when I told them her job.
Yeah.
They didn't know who the Who was even.
Oh.
But my brother, who I look up to as my kind of junior dad, he's like dad too.
Yeah,
he's the
cool.
nicer dad, the nicer younger dad. He knew about the Who, and so that impressed
Brett.
That's great.
Great. Oh man, that's like a little checkbox on your like list of people to meet. But like
I'm done chasing famous people down. I've already nailed it.
Playing the Royal Albert Hall. That must have been, what a rush. Is that like, that's up there on your comedy? Like,
well, you know what?
Plinth.
Because it's a charity gig, they're super nice. But also, that doesn't guarantee anything because my stuff's quite out there and surreal, or especially at that time. But I was hitting the zeitgeist at the time because I was on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, and I was on the team of Noel. So people who were getting me. So gigs are becoming easier than they'd ever been because people knew what to expect. Whereas before, people would go, why is he talking like that and shouting? Whereas then they were going, oh, this guy's surreal, so he's going to be like this guy, you know. So there was a bit of recognition in the audience, which helped. But also, I had just met Roger, and that's all I could think about. So I just strutted around that stage.
Great.
And it was, again, one of these other things where I fuck everything up because the gig was so good. I just thought, well, that's me now. I am on my way.
Yeah.
I do not need to keep the gas on the pedal.
Yeah, it's just relaxing
out. To me, I win. Like, I become too easily satisfied. I thought, well, I've done the Royal Albert Hall. What's next?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, shit, I've got to make a living. Fuck,
yeah, that's
that.
Right. That's right.
I was strutting around out there. I became really like backstage meeting all the kids with the cancer. And I was really good at relating to all of them because I was not scared to be honest and say risky things to them or tease them. And Roger had noticed that and he just saw, this guy's great. A few months later, maybe it was even a year later, I can't remember anyway. But I started going on hospital visits just because it was starting to make me feel good. And I would be really honest about it, going, this makes me feel good to make you feel good.
Great.
And I had a little bit of fame, so the odd person in hospital knew who I was, but most of them didn't have a clue, which didn't matter. We would always laugh about that. It's going, who's this dink visiting me?
Yeah.
Just so he could feel good about himself. And we'd laugh and high five.
Oh,
and
great.
Anyway, Roger, just he couldn't open up one of the rock shows one time. He's one of the really great ones, but he's a working class guy who he's a bit like us. Anyway, it'll come to me and I'll tell you and you can say it at the end of the thing.
Yeah.
The, Anyway, so I had to go on stage and introduce the charity.
Yeah.
And then the gig would start after that. And I was to go up. So I went backstage and I met up with a few of the kids. And our thing was, we're going to go up and explain. One of them was going to be a speech. I think his name was Ian. He was going to talk about the charity and stuff and what it means. And because we're trying to get the rich folks out there to donate money,
yeah,
you know, need your money. So one of the guys is wearing an eye patch because his cancer had eaten away at his eye. Like,
you're right.
Horrific. But we were joking, and I was going, can I do a pirate joke? Can I say my favorite pirate?
Yeah.
You know, oh, no, because I got a Somali pirate routine. And so can I call you like my favorite Somali pirate? You know, anyway. And there was a few other jokes. Like, I came on and I went, here's some of the guys from the charity. And I'd go, they seem fine to me. I don't know what the fuss is about. That was my opening one. These guys, they seem healthy to me. You know, look at them. They're up here on stage.
Yeah.
Let's go home. And like jokes like that. The audience was a bit,
oh,
okay. Roger wouldn't, you know, they're laughing. But the most important thing, what Roger heard about and all the WHO people heard about, was that the kids were laughing. And there was a few hundred of them. That's their big outing, is to go to those gigs every year. And there's hundreds of them. They're just howling at the temerity. And also they loved that the audience was a bit kind of wary.
Tense.
So they were screaming. And of course, all the organizers are only looking at the kids.
That's
true. I mean, there's the odd person thinking, is this going to hurt donations?
But yeah.
And then I introduced, now coming up to say a few words about the charity, I want to introduce you to my favorite Somali, Ian.
Yeah.
I forgot the pirate part. So he comes up with just an eye patch on.
Yeah.
And he's a white kid with cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and it just went silent. But all the other kids are so howling that a laughter sort of finally made its way around the room.
Great.
But it was both mortifying and kind of life-changing all at the same time. It's kind of magical.
Amazing. That's amazing, man. That's such a nice thing to do, to give something back, like especially those charity gigs. You know we're only here for a short time, and you don't know when you're going to go. It can all be taken a little bit too seriously, but I love the fact you could just maybe just ride that wave of silliness as well, because you're just being honest, and the kids are going to be honest about what they see anyway. Face value, they're going to take it out, isn't it? They're not going to look further.
A really nice thing, a few years ago, 2017 I think, I did a thing called Tony Law on Ice, where I was sitting in a pub in the Bill Murray, where they, you know the Bill Murray?
Yep.
I was sitting in the Bill Murray, and someone said, what kind of thing would you like to do that's out there? Talking to the bartender, and I said, I don't know, something like Tony Law on Ice. That'd be great. It'd be me, I'd do stand up on ice. And overheard me was a little kid called Adam Larter. And he went, oh, you know, I could do that. And anyway, we just became friends. He's about 15, 20 years, my junior. He just went and wrote a stupid play with loads of props.
Yeah.
And we approached Alexander Palace ice rink. And anyway, long organizational thing, but we put on Tony Law on Ice, which was a play. None of the cast could skate.
Right.
And it was very dangerous.
Yeah.
We probably could have got sued badly, but luckily they were comedians nearly smashing their heads.
I'll bet.
My kids were in it dressed as bears.
Great.
And it was just a big spectacle. We sold 500 tickets. Great. But one of the neat things was at the end, I was approached by a young lady of about, I guess, 24 or, 20, or whatever. And her family came over and they said, do you remember me? You visited us at the Teenage Cancer Trust wing ward of the UCL hospital. And I was like, oh my God, like I could. But when I saw her, she was a kid and she had no hair and all that. But I recognized her sister and her mom who were there on our visit.
Yeah.
And they just thought, they loved Storm, my wife, because Storm went on all the visits and she was actually a lot better with them, because I was always trying to make jokes and she was just like, really able to connect on a human level.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they came and she's like, she fully recovered.
Wow.
Like 100% young woman, this great long hair. Not that that's important. So that was nice. That put a real
That's great, man. That's
came to the ice show, yeah.
You feel like, I used to work as a, I worked as a hospital porter for a summer once. And you know what? It was one of the most rewarding jobs I ever had. You know, you weren't a doctor, but you had to get the patient to where they need to be and keep them at ease and be nice to them. And if they're stressed, say, don't worry, these people look after you. It was such
the most important person, isn't it?
Yeah, it was good.
You know, when you think of yourself, when you've ever been in a traumatic situation, it's not the big wigs, it's the little people who move you around that you remember, isn't it?
That's it. The same person would you pick, you know, you pick them up after the theatre thing, and you're like, oh yeah, you know, if you're getting on now, you're right, or whatever it was. It's just so nice. You're just connecting with people, aren't you, properly, like at a normal level, human level. Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Holy shit, you remember that and you took the time to come and say hi to me. Yeah. Well, she was one of the few people who knew who I was when I did the visit.
Yeah.
So she was actually like, she was really pleased to meet me.
That's great, man.
And some of them are just going, I don't know who you are. I love that, though. Yeah. So like, yeah, no, I don't blame you.
You watch, you're really Patch Adamsing it up. Like, that's great, man. That's really, really good. I love it. Brilliant.
Yeah, and just so sarcastic and smartass, all of us, just for good times, actually.
In your biography, you said you came over for like The Who and Monty Python. Have you ever managed to gig with any of the crew from the Monty Python sketches?
No, but I told this story on the Adam Buxton podcast the other night, but I want to tell it again because it's the most out of anything in my rather average life. I would say the thing that was the most comedy informative, or you know, the biggest thing, was some of the farms, you know, they would have a party for high school kids, 16, 17, and all the kids, they would have a big bonfire out in the field, and kids would drive, and the adults would make sure nobody was driving with and drinking. So they'd have these big country parties, and you'd never go to the house. You never usually went to the house, but the Landmarks and neighbors of ours had a big party. You know when a party just gets crashed and suddenly there's just tons of people? And I was only 15, and so I was allowed in the house to go, you know, chill out and watch movies. The party was getting raging out there, and that's where all the focus was. And so in the house, in their kind of den, I guess their living room or whatever, they had movies on for the nerdy kids. About 5 or 6 people, and I didn't really know any of them. They were sort of more nerdy than me. Anyway, Monty Python was on, the Holy Grail, and I'd never heard of Monty Python.
Yeah.
And I watched it, and I remember starting to watch it, not quite. Remember, and I was a history nerd my whole life. We had no books in the house, but we had the Encyclopedia Britannica from 1967. Yeah. So mom and dad bought that over a course of 5 years or something like that. I would read all the history, and I loved the smell of the books. Smell the books. So I read history, and there was also cartoons on before school. So I was a history nut. It's like a historical movie, which I dig.
Great.
But it's comedy, and the jokes were so, like, it got through to me like a laser. It shot through into my heart, and I didn't actually laugh the first time. My mouth was open, and I was kind of going the whole time, and I was looking at the other people, and they were kind of laughing too, but I was going, something was breaking.
It's like you're upgrading. It's like you're downloading the firmware.
I felt like I was broken. Great. Something had broken. And then by the end of the first time through, I was laughing so hard. I was crying, but I was weeping, you know.
Brilliant.
And we put it on straight again.
Yeah.
A couple of the other people were getting infected by me, so we were weeping. And then at some point, I stopped laughing again. And I just cried. I thought, this is it. This is the greatest thing I've ever experienced in my life. And I think I ever will. And I've never, then I got laughing again. And I've never laughed like that since. I mean, I've gotten close with my wife when we were on holiday. We took a holiday one time before the kids to Cuba. So it ticked all the boxes. Our socialist kind of bullshit. Cuba, you know, Yeah, she just had me laughing on the beach so hard. She goes into the water, like topless beach, you know, so gorgeous wife goes into the beach and stuffs seaweed down the front of her bikini bottoms and pants, and it's coming, it's just spilling out. She comes back, funny. She goes, "Oh, I think I can't get me back in me pouch." The jokes are better than that, but it was like that, and we're smoking massive cigars.
Great.
Anyway, she was just riffing, and
yeah,
that was as close as I got. But that Monty Python changed everything. I thought, this is all there is in the world, is this kind of weird, like, who would have thought to taunt people from the top of a castle? Of course you would. Go That's away.
It. Yeah, yeah. You're in the power. You've got the power. King
Tiny
of the castle.
Brain whoppers. I loved it.
Brilliant. And like, is the Holy Grail your favorite Monty Python sketch?
I would say Life of Brian overtook it for a while.
Right. Okay.
And actually, I watched it. I've watched it every few years for years. There was a time it didn't make me laugh, actually, because I kind of maybe overdid it. But I watched it again with my daughter, and she just howled. And then it really, and then it reminded me of why it was funny. And they started doing it around the house. But I let them listen to or watch it when they were a bit young.
Yeah.
But then my wife, her father, who's an old military guy, he's dead, long dead, died when she's like six. Her mom used to say he used to inappropriately take the kids to the cinema. And he took them to the Holy Grail when they were like 6 years old, which is way too young.
Yeah.
Can't call me out on watching this too young with the kids, because her dad did that to her. It's like a tradition now. The kids have to do that to their kids.
The cycle of abuse continues, isn't it? I really like the short stories they did as well. What are they called?
Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
The meaning? No, the, you know, the ones with the short stories they did.
Keep
short
talking.
Stories.
Tell me about your favorite.
It's, for me, I think it's definitely the Holy Grail is just brilliant. It's just from my childhood. Watched it with my friends, and it was just, we always do take off the sketch, you know, skits from it. It was brilliant.
That wouldn't have happened without old Beatles guy George Harrison. He funded that. So that's what got it made, I believe, because he just loved Monty Python, and just used his own Beatle money. I love a bit of that Beatle money.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Can't figure out what the short stories were.
Oh,
but the sketches of the Flying Circus.
Let me look.
Flying Circus. Has Monty Python been cancelled by the new cancel culture? That just popped up on my phone. Here's a good story about Alfred, my granddad, who was from Lesburn, and he got put in an orphanage when he was 8. His mum had 17 kids. Loads of them died in childbirth, but a few survived, but she met a man once her husband had died who was going off to Canada. I think they were not giving land, but if you had a little bit of money, you could get a small bit of land in Canada.
Yeah.
So Canada was begging people to come over to farm this land. Anyway, so she put him in an orphanage and left with the guy and his 8 kids or whatever it was. And so Alfie, then he worked in some, like, you know, factories or work, what do they call them, workhouses or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of, you know, early 20th century bollocks. And then he went to World War I by stealing one of his dead brother's identities.
Whoa, yeah.
Yeah, called him, so he could go to World War I at 15.
Wow.
Apparently that happened a lot.
That's like, it's mad, isn't it? You're stealing someone's identity, like, who's dead, to go and fight in a war where you might die as well. I mean, that is horrific, isn't it?
Because we look back and we see all the footage of the, you know, the carnage. I mean, they knew that it was pretty dangerous, but there was also a great way, if you're uber poor and from Ireland, Northern Ireland, or most of England, most working class people. I mean, there's a reason why they went.
Yep, that's it.
Without it's
jobs.
Get away from this shithole.
That's right.
Because it wasn't like, you know, it's like the 10% of Britain were the ones enjoying the spoils of empire. The rest of the people were working on cotton jennies and down mines and child labourers.
Yeah.
So yeah,
trying to survive.
He went, did that, came back from World War I, and then same thing happened to him. He got married to Gertie. They had Cecil, my oldest uncle, and he had a brother called Cecil as well. Anyway, so off he went to all the way over to Alberta, Canada, and 8 miles down the road was his mum who had abandoned him. He didn't go out there to join her. It was a fluke.
Accident. Wow.
So she'd put him in an orphanage. Yeah. Not like, I'm going to come back and get you.
Or yeah.
She put him in an orphanage and like, have a good life. It's going to be better without me.
Yeah.
She was there and he just happened to be dropped in this spot near his mum. Now, this is the part that makes me laugh. But I mean, it's tragic if you think about it too long, but never really spoke about it, about how it felt to see his mum who had abandoned him about 8 miles or whatever it was down the road. Unbelievable.
Wow.
Like, how would that make you feel? Like 20 years later or whatever it was. And there they are.
And they never spoke about it. Did they form a relationship after that? Or?
No, God, no.
Right.
No, just ignored each other and she died shortly in. And he just, you know, he didn't talk. He had his own farm to fail at.
Right. Right, okay.
I mean, because they got these people from cities that didn't know how to farm.
Yeah.
One of the saviors of ours might have been Gertie. It came from a tiny little plot near Newry. I don't know how they met, Gertie and Alfie.
Wow.
To meet someone from the same, your mom.
Yeah, that's so, it's like homing pigeons, isn't it? You know, it's like, cause when I, like, this is a very small comparison to that story, but that is incredible that, like, you know, your family 8 miles down the road. When I came over to the UK, 2000, and I went to a place, there was a club. Loads of people, like there's about 7 rooms in this club, massive, like you would, if you lost your friends, that was it, they were gone for the night, you'd never find them again. And I was at the back of the room and like this woman said, Winter. I was like, oh, and it was a friend of mine from West Cork who was in there and I was like, what are you doing here? You know, it's so weird. Like that's, we have like a magnetism with people, you know, I think it's really odd, isn't it, sometimes?
Why are you here?
Yeah, totally. It just blew my mind. But that's amazing. That's an amazing story. A sad story too, but I found
I mean, it's so long ago now, but, and yeah, you can go to these stories long ago and make them too like, oh,
yeah.
But you know, that's good to know, because then you can forgive the person like Alf for all of his foibles. You know, my dad wasn't able to forgive him because of his, you know, his alcoholism, and dad wasn't able to think about, well, maybe that was the PTSD brought back from World War One, or maybe because his mother abandoned him and turned up in freaking, like, it's easier my generation to be able to look back and be forgiving of all of those people. And one thing to hand it to my dad is he kind of stopped the alcoholism. Like he just didn't drink. And then I picked up the baton that he left on the floor. I said, hey, somebody left this on the floor.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I got this one. I got this.
I have none of Elfie's excuses. Oh, so it's a bit, well.
Yeah, you're trying to sharp. Look, you said, look, I've got is a groove. I don't have a full chip. I need to make this chip better.
Yeah. I have to nosedive my own life.
That's where the art is. That's where the despair and all the creativity comes from. I love it.
Earned it.
Totally, that's what it is. So I found out what that show was, and it was Monty Python's Ripping Yarns. It's brilliant.
Oh.
Check that out if you haven't seen it.
I will do, yeah. I probably know it.
Yeah, you probably know it. It's got the monkey's claws, one of the famous sketches in it, but it's brilliant. I said it an hour, I don't want to take up too much of your time, because I'm looking at respectful of your evening.
That's good. I mean, who doesn't love talking about themselves?
Oh, God, yeah, it's the best thing ever, right?
Also, I just like talking about Alfie and Gertie and Donald Edward and Ronald Edwin.
Right.
That's the name of the twins. That's fucking
there's funny. I bet they were common names back then.
Talk about working class Protestant Northern Irish people with with the names. Just like, there's like sending out Esther, Cecil.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's Donald, it. Ronald.
Yeah.
But their middle names, Edwin, like real Anglo-Saxon names that they couldn't possibly. So funny.
Yeah.
But, and I remember having teachers from, you know, Irish Catholic teachers at school. And they would always, I remember Liam McNiff asking me about granddad.
Yeah.
And asking me all these questions. And then granddad asking me all these questions about Liam. Yeah. And I was wondering what was going on there.
Yeah.
They were sizing each other up.
How many dogs you got? Do you have a sausage dog as well?
Yeah, no, the sausage dogs died a few years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Two dogs, two cats, two twins. Well, one set of twins, two kids.
Wow.
Mum and dad, two bedrooms. A lot of life up here on the third floor.
I ask this every person I have on the show. I said, now, in comedy, right, when you first started, what was your first joke, if you remember?
I think I stole it off of a bridge,
right,
which was 668, neighbor of the beast.
Right.
That really tickled me, and it was on a bridge. Never seen it since, but yeah, I did that for years.
Because you riff so much as well. I mean, when I first started, like, I was like, well, watch your stuff online, and I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant. And like, I was so like in awe of what you did, because I was nowhere near doing that at the time, you know? And I met you coming back from English Comedy Brussels on the tube, and I asked to take a picture with you as well. I don't know if you remember that, but anyway, it was years ago.
Yes.
And that was when I was like just starting out, and I was getting some good.
Where was
nice
that
gigs.
Where did you?
I think that was either I think it was King's Cross or something. I was
that's
just coming
right
in.
It was on the tube.
Yeah, that's right,
out front of the tube, like on the platform.
That's right, on the platform. Yeah. And I was like, hey, Tony Law.
Oh,
I was like, there
God,
he is.
I remember it
when I was watching your stuff.
Wait I yeah, love sorry. This sort of stuff. Had you been to a gig?
Yeah.
Yes, you'd been to O2 or something.
No, English Comedy Brussels. English Comedy Brussels.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, you said, yeah, I'm doing that next week. I was like, but I went when the time was, it was the World Cup and Brussels were playing, so it wasn't a very, very busy gig.
Oh,
but
gosh.
It was like, hey, look, it was really fun to do. I did with Chris Martin and Daliso Chapunda.
I love Chris Martin a lot. And
great.
Chapunda,
yeah.
God, we go way back. I've done some car journeys with him.
Yeah.
God, I used to take the piss out of him and him. Me, love him.
It's great. I remember your sketch about the shark and the bear.
Oh, yeah. That's going
love
back
that.
Now.
Love that.
Do you know, I accidentally saw that the other night and I thought I could do that way better now. Like, I'm a way better performer than I was then.
Yeah.
The material was actually okay, but I didn't know how to make it weird and silly. It was, but that's nice. Yeah,
it's great. I loved it, man. I was really like, you were my heroes at the beginning, at the very beginning, like, you know. And it's just a pleasure to have you on. And I ask this one other thing, like, you know, you're riffing and stuff, and you know, you say that it's kind of hard when someone interrupts you. So I mean, like, I had a bit of a problem at the very beginning with controlling my energy in the correct way, because if I got interrupted or it wasn't going my way, I would get very angry. And trying to put that into the doesn't make a good gig go well for you.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And, for me personally, and I don't think you have that, I think it might come from the fact that I interrupt people. No, I've still not nailed that, actually.
Right.
You know, I get too distracted and too, it's just a lack of confidence. Of,
right.
Like, just thinking, you know, I'm worth listening to.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and my wife and I even had a conversation about this today. Yeah, you know, like how you can throw an entire gig because someone's talking.
Yeah.
Do you know, my answer was to go to art centers and just do it to my own people and try and cultivate a small audience of really polite, kind people. That's my goal, is to just play to kind people.
Safe space.
Yeah. I know, it's not the way you get to the top.
No,
it's the
like
way you keep where you are.
Yeah, like, there's nothing wrong with that at all, is there? It's like, look, you know, why do you have to try and convince them every time? Why do I have to? I know I'm doing what is right, you know, because you know yourself, and you got that other person over there has got something wrong with them.
It's one of the reasons I really like comedians, because comedians know more about you than anyone else.
Mm.
Comedians are always very kind to me. I quite like that.
Yeah,
I mean, you wouldn't know the ones who aren't.
Yeah, of course.
Kind. I love finding an act that I like, because I can't keep too many names in my head, but I like finding an act I like and then sort of just go into town on their behalf. And my new one is Ola Labib, who's like, she grew up in the UK. She's UK, but her parents, I think, are from Sudan.
Right.
And she does comedy from a Muslim perspective, but she does it in a kind of surreal, just funny bones, you know, when someone's got funny bones. So that's my new one that I'm just like, anyone who'll listen, because I think, like, how many of us know anyone with Sudanese parents? I don't. I mean, my kids probably do, but I don't, and I just want to hear their perspective. And also, it's mostly actually that she's got funny bones. I love funny bones.
You know what, right? There's like a thing that's hilarious about comedy, is that comedy's the only job in the world where people go, oh God, we're sick of listening to these idiots. We want idiots from this country because they sound different. So we'll pay them to come here to entertain us. Isn't that it's so ridiculous. Hilarious, though. It's like, oh, they're exotic. Okay, great. I love it. Brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, though, going over to Belfast way back during the Troubles doing gigs. I just getting a free ride compared to the English acts, you know. I remember when it wasn't Jake, but it was one of the regular hosts at the Empire. It was so naughty. It was Nick Wilty, who had been in Northern Ireland as a trooper.
Right.
As a soldier.
Wow.
It wasn't Jake. It was one of those guys. And he said, this next act. So this is 1999 or something.
Right.
This next act's from England. No one says anything. And he's been here before. Not to this gig, but he's been here before. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Wilty. And they went on and he was getting booed.
Wow.
And it was horrific. But he stood his ground.
Yeah.
And he just slowly chipped away at it with his surreal thing. And I think that's one of my favorite Belfast stories.
Great.
I used to get away with so much. And then I would try and be cheeky with it. And I would try and tease the audience and say, because it was very famous, the Empire, during the Troubles, where there would be big guys or whatever they would call them, like proper bad men.
Yeah, yeah.
In from both sides. It used to be some sort of weird psycho thing they would do and go and like watch the same gig. And I would try and work out everybody in the front and go, I'm trying to work it. Yeah, you're wearing a rugby shirt, so I'm thinking you're probably on that side. And also, you've got a kind of dumb look about you.
Yeah.
And then I go over to the next guy and I go, well, you got some very clear skin and quite freckly, so I'm thinking you're on that side.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do all this cheeky shit, and they loved it.
Great.
So I was really lucky there. But yeah, to back up your thing, I just hope things settle down and there's no more need for like trend. Oh.
What was the hardest gig you've ever had to do then, Tony?
Too many to mention. Oh,
like the one that you just go, oh God, duh.
So Australia 2005, I was having a terrible time at the festival. I was drinking too much.
Right.
I realized that I, in hindsight, I just got some stuff I've never really sorted out. And I was drinking and I was very discombobulated, dislocated, thinking I'm fine. Anyway, gigs were bad. And then they have this big sort of gala at the end at the Hi-Fi Club. I think it was the Hi-Fi, something like that.
Right.
Whatever it's called. But loads of acts. It's the last night. Mm. Everyone wants to party and they just stick on, you know, whatever. And the final act was the Umbilical Brothers,
right,
who are huge in Australia, or were. And they do, I don't even know what they do, acrobatics and comedy and
right,
like full-on proper show. The Aussies love a freaking big show. I mean, you would if you're at the end of the world in a boring culture like Australia. You need big entertainment. I fucking hate Australia. No, I don't. I just hate myself in Australia.
It's because they're south, isn't it? You're from Canada, you know, it's like north-south divide, right?
Yeah. And anyway, these guys, the Umbilical Brothers, said, no, we can't go on last. We have to go on second to last.
Oh.
They made some technical thing.
Right.
And I was stood at the bar with Sean Locke, Stuart Lee, and the promoter of the whole show. And I was going, oh, what? I said, I'm not. I thought I was going second to last.
Yeah.
And I just want to do 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And they're going, no, you got to close it. And Sean Locke goes, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
He says, that's like putting Phil Collins on before, and then he kept naming really shitty musical acts. That's like putting the Rolling Stones on before fucking, you know, the Monkees.
Yeah.
You can't do that. But
oh, no.
There was something about the way he was taking the piss out of the promoters being my mate.
Yeah.
That kind of filled me with a small amount of confidence. And
I
went to the back and I found some coveralls, you know, some, what do you get, boiler suit.
Yeah.
And I found a baseball cap.
Great.
And I just thought, oh, I'm going to be... I'm not going to be like a silly guy with a fancy haircut who thinks he's in a band in London. I'm just going to be a real Canadian redneck and fuck this gig. And I just went out shouting. And I just went, so, you know, when you're fucking, you're shoving a guy's feet into a wood chipper, right? And I just started yeah. with that. And I just started saying all the most crazy, proper redneck. I was being where I'm from.
Yeah.
But a serial killer from there. And it just lit up. And it went great.
Oh, great.
But, so it's that's not the worst gig ever, obviously, right. but it was terrifying on the run-up.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It's but like, I used that opportunity to big myself up.
Nice, I like that. You flipped it. That's you jujitsu'd my question. I really love it.
Yeah,
always a positive. The positivity is brilliant. Was going to say to you now. Okay, then. Mm. So, like, you're the one where you just was like, okay, for a situation when it's not going well, how do you stop yourself from like just getting angry, basically?
Well, when I used to do a lot of, you know, when Jonglers yeah. was about, that was a great way to pay your rent. Those yeah. were good gigs, paid some money, but I died all the time. And what I would do, and this, you know, worked against me, is I would, if I got to 11 minutes and I was booked to do 20, and I was just dying on my hole, I'd cut it short to save the gig.
Yeah.
And then they started to cut my wages too, which is... Do you know what? I had to not complain. Other people complained on my behalf, but I just thought, no, I think I'm doing the right thing. You know, you'd have two gigs that went really well, and then you'd just be dying on your hole. And there was no rhyme nor reason to it. I remember doing Reading when loads of soldiers were in.
Right.
It was just full, like, 200 squatties,
yeah.
like proper grunts. Everybody in the dressing room was sort of clearing out before I went on because they just assumed I'm going to get eaten alive.
Yeah.
But for some reason, squatties liked what I was doing, my surreal kind of mentalness. So I would do good. And then the next night, everyone's being really nice because they think I'm going to absolutely nail it. He was great with the squatties and now he's got a normal crowd in. But the normal crowd were just... And these are working class people. We should be getting along. But I guess I just couldn't connect with them sometimes, you know? I guess I'm like that, like you maybe, or a lot of us. We might have that background, but we kind of connect with maybe nerds and, you know, outsiders.
Introverts, isn't it?
Maybe.
The Jonglers is also a franchise as well, isn't it? So it's people who want to be going out and are in the same sort of group. They don't necessarily want to go out, but they're going out because their friends are going. Do you know what I mean? That there's no...
Yeah, well, there was that thing where if no one is going to listen or give you any respect, then I guess I have no confidence. Whereas I think with the squatties, as crazy as they were, you know, they all watched from the beginning and then I could get them. They gave me a chance.
Two last questions then, Tony. Which is your favorite show of all the shows you've done?
I think only because it's recent. When I got in the middle of the two lockdowns, I finally got a gig off its feet in Alexander's in Chester. And with social distancing, we could get 45 people in.
Great.
We were all so happy to be out. And I was just, I was so nervous. I didn't know what it was I did. I couldn't remember my material, but it all came back. And I guess the feeling I had after that, I drove home, like it felt like 10 minutes to drive home, all the way to London. But I guess I was going fast.
Yeah.
But no, it just felt so good. Ever since I've started doing my own little tour shows, even if there's like 110 people or whatever, those are almost all of them feel good like that.
I should be more specific. Like that's the most recent one, but like your the name of your like solo show.
Oh, you mean the shows I've done, I get.
Yeah.
And I say not 2012, that's the one that won a ton of awards.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, I had to drop that.
What was the awards, Tony?
No big deal. You can look them up.
No, what were they called? What was it?
I won a bunch of chortles.
Oh yeah.
And then I won about five, I think. And then I nominated for the Edinburgh Award.
Yeah.
But it was the show the year after, 2013.
Right.
That I liked the most.
Great.
Because I came on with laser fingers.
Oh, brilliant.
And there was also, there's actually bits from shows. There was another show where I played catch with an enormous giant beach ball with a member from the audience while listening to Journey. And there was something about that routine, which was, I loved it because it's pure clowning.
Yeah.
So I like that the most.
You're actually physically playing with the audience, aren't you? Just throwing a beach ball back and forth, right?
Yeah, and it takes nothing away. Like, they don't have to commit to anything. All they have to do is play catch.
Yeah.
There's something about playing catch that I think is a real human... I don't know. I used to give myself loads of philosophical background to every decision I'd make.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start doing that again because it makes you feel like you're doing something worthy.
Yeah, like a fine art degree.
Yeah. Because my wife's into art and my daughter's an artist and my mother-in-law. So I just think try and talk to yourself like you're an artist and it makes you feel better.
You treat everything with respect. It's like the process.
I think so. Like yourself.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Okay, one last thing then before we go. When you first started doing comedy compared to now, did you ever model yourself on any? You could, now this is a open-ended question. I've had people who have modeled themselves and they say that they have compared to a job or an animal or a being. Broad question, so take your time. So like, I've had people say that they see themselves in comedy as a PCSO, but police community support officer, IT technician. I've had plumber. Yeah. Like, so do you have an archetype or a role model or job in mind?
Well, it's changed over the years a lot.
Okay.
I think that my most successful period was when I looked at myself as an adventurer, where I had the hair and the trousers that came up under the waist with, you know, the braces and I was like somebody venturing out and taking everyone with me on a journey. So I think adventurer, and in looking back, I've applied Alexander the Great to me because I've been getting into Greece and all of that, you know, and Persia. Yeah. And I just thought, oh, yeah, that's what I was trying to be, Alexander the Great.
Mm.
But some sort of adventure. And then I remember meeting Dylan Moran one time.
Yeah.
Came to a gig, and I think I was still struggling with when I first stopped drinking in 2016 or 17. And I had no confidence, and he took me aside and did a big long chat with me. He took me out. He did this elliptical speech to me.
Right.
He was trying to save me. He was trying to say, you know, you've got to think of yourself as a doctor. You've got the medicine, Tony.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful and kind of him to do it, but he was trying to say, you're really funny and you clearly don't believe it. And it didn't sink in right away. I wasn't someone who just went, yep, fixed. It's taken a few years and it's all sunk in. It's like a real poet, like a thing a poet would do for another poet or something. That's something I probably don't actually mention enough out loud, but he kind of put me on the right track again, I guess.
Yes, nice.
He would have said a doctor, we're doctors, but I would say an adventurer.
Adventurer. One last thing, what's your favorite part of history?
Well, it would have to be at the moment. I like going way back.
Okay.
My favorite of all time is the Dark Ages. Like when the Roman Empire leaves the Western Roman Empire, it collapses. There's something horrific and dark about that period of like, what would that be like?
Yeah.
That kind of total collapse. Yeah. And we know so little about it because everything went. There was no learning and and nothing. It was proper dark. So that period. And then I suppose I enjoy the Greece-Persia stuff. So, I would say those two.
So in your own period of history of being an adventurer, are you now in the Enlightenment or are you in the Renaissance?
No, I'm way before those days.
Right.
That's kind of out of my remit. There's too much politically that could go wrong. I like things that I can get my head around. Like,
cool.
My thing about history is that Europe seems to be portrayed by people who don't know about history as this kind of this rapacious modern people who are going to places and stealing and taking. And I've got this theory about it. I think that the Europeans lived so dark and so poor for so long that when they got a chance to be on top, they just went nuts. Because I think that that's the thing that people seem to forget. It's like most of the people in Britain and Europe were not beneficiaries of things like slave trade.
Mm.
You know, most people were actually working down factories as children. Yep. Like there was loads of people who were exploited. And I think that's a thing that might start to be more in the public consciousness. Yeah. But I, and also, like, even if you go back to, like, the Roman Empire, we seem to glorify it. But, you know, 40% of the population at some point were enslaved. So, like, all cultures, you can look at them with rose-tinted glasses, but they've all got some dark shit going on.
That's true.
And I think, and even the Vikings, like, we seem to go, Vikings, yeah, just adventures. But they kept slaves from everybody they conquered.
Yep.
Slavs, literally, that comes from slaves. Well, so humanity is awful all the way around.
That's true. And like we were saying about like the Europe, like, yeah, everyone was like a slave or working for someone else until the bubonic plague, when they started actually paying people because everyone was dying and they couldn't get anyone to work or feed the castles.
Yes, but
or
then that reverted back eventually to, yeah, I mean, it was a small advance, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But then it sort of went back.
And of course.
And then there was like Ireland had great periods. Yeah. And then suddenly was like viewed as this impoverished backwater when it used to be kind of leading light in some way or whatever. Yeah. But I love all of that. But I spend all my time, any time I read is going quite a far back. So the Enlightenment stuff, I don't touch because I don't know enough about it. And I don't know, it's not for me.
A bit like reading the Brexit dossier, is it? You're like, it's just down a rabbit hole that it never ends. You're like, I know what you're saying. I like the big strokes, right?
Yeah, but I don't know, like, the more I've learned about, like, China's history and Persia's history and how there's been these great empires all over the world, the Kush Empire, the Kushan Empire, and you know, the more you learn about all the far-flung corners of the world, the more you realize that Europe was such a poor backward, really backward-thinking, you know, like a nightmare of thuggery and misery. And I think that should be taught more, you know, because there's people out there that think of Rule Britannia as this, you know, didn't we have an empire and all that? But actually, there's a very brief period for this tiny population at the top.
Yeah,
you know, if you really viewed it truthfully, you'd realize it was like far behind Han China or Ming China or all the Chinas.
The dynasties, that's true, man.
Persia was an absolute powerhouse, and then the Arab conquest. And, I mean, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
All of that.
That's true. Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you for the last hour and nearly a half, but sorry for keeping you longer than that, but I just wanted to just squeeze you.
I had a really good time. I've enjoyed it.
It's
love
great.
Talking history. So.
It's been an absolute pleasure, man. Your show is it Virtual Echo Chamber?
Channel is called Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo on Twitch, and the show I do is The Tone Zone.
The Tone Zone.
But I think if you put Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo or Tony Law, and it should lead you there, hopefully.
And you're on all the socials as just Mr. Tony Law, or?
Yep, Mr. Tony Law.
Brilliant. Okay, and have you got another show you're writing at the moment you're going to bring out soon, or?
Nope.
Cool.
Yeah, sort of, but no.
No, okay, fine.
It'll be there, but not great. Not yet.
All right, well, Tony, thank you so much for spending an hour or so on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, thanks, mate. Thanks so much. It's been really fun. Thank you.
And that was episode 110 with one of my comedy heroes that just sort of inspired me in comedy. I was like, wow, I love what you do. Staying connected with the audience, just riding that wave, surfing it, seeing where it goes. And as I say, on this podcast, you get to hear some nuggets of information. And that conversation you had with Dylan Moran, it was like, yeah, you know, you're an adventurer, Tony. You know, you're the doctor, he said. Believe you're funny. That's it. If you want to get a tattoo, guys, and you're a comedian, I'd say get that. But it's just a pleasure to speak to Tony about comedy. He's such a lovely guy. He's closed my gigs in Hemel, Abbots Langley, all the gigs I had around Hertfordshire. And he's a lovely guy to have on a bill and an excellent comedian. He will not fail your night. He is just such when I had him in my gig in Hemel Hempstead, the power went out and we continued the gig. It was just a random thing happened. Just power went out and the gig was just as random as anything. It just continued and just flowed and just went to its natural end as well. Nothing got phased. We just carried on, had a laugh. It's crazy. But yeah, it was just perfect night with Tony. He's just brilliant, brilliant comedian. And look, go and check him out. He's on all the socials as Mr. Tony Law. He's on Twitch as The Tone Zone, and it's a Virtue Chamber Echo Bravo. So go and check that stuff out there on all the socials. He does live Twitch streams as well. Brilliant comedian, very funny man, and one of my comedy heroes, what can I say? 110 episode, that was just one of my favorites. Next month for March, we've got another comedian that I absolutely love. That's what I love about doing this podcast. I get to speak to the comedians that I've always wanted to speak to. And when I did my first Edinburgh run in 2013, there was three of us went up. One person quit before we got to Edinburgh, but it was too late. He was already on the posters and flyers. So me and this other guy who doesn't do comedy anymore, called Nick Root, had to do half an hour each. And we did it in a place called the Jekyll and Hyde. And we didn't have big audiences. We were on at 11:45 at night and across on Princes Street where there's not much footfall. But we only had to cancel a couple of shows. We did a show every night. And you know what, right? It made us better comedians. And we got through it. We had a mad time. But you know what? Had junkies in one time. We'd see Norwegian women in another time. And they were lovely. The junkies were nice too. They offered me drugs. And I was like, look, I'm kind of busy right now. But you know what, right? Thanks for the offer. I do appreciate that. But please put a fiver in the bucket and not drugs. But you know what, right? So I did that. But in between the shows, right? So I had loads of time in the day to watch shows. And I went to see an act that we have on in March. And he is just a bit like Tony, not very easy to describe. But we'll talk about that in the show. His name is Trevor Locke, and that is for March's episode. Do not miss that one. That is some wonderful bits of info about comedy and about how to do it and how to just follow it and stay connected with it. It's a wonderful episode that just shows you the workings behind the laughter. See you in March. Till then.